Hello, welcome to the first weekend of the Obama era. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop. We've got a new president with a popular mandate. People are losing their homes, their jobs, their retirements. In this week of national transformation and genuine uncertainty, who do we really need to hear from? Celebrities. Oprah dragged her whole show out to D.C. for the inauguration. And in the middle of a sea of real humanity, on Martin Luther King Day, no less, this is the best they could come up with.
We've got so much to celebrate, and there are a lot of people who feel like I do. So let's get started and welcome Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher.
I feel like I am living a dream.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to get emotional.
You are living a dream. It's called endless money and lots of time on my hands. Let's hear from an American actually affected by the economy. Like this, slightly unfortunately phrased insight from Justin Timberlake.
The day after the election, I woke up with a little swagger in my step. I think now, more than ever, it's a call to action to every American to put your nose to the grindstone, roll up your sleeves, and, you know, get to work.
Yo, snap, JT says time to get to work, people. Oprah. Meanwhile, in the real world, one of our listeners and friends wrote in to say she's ignoring expiration dates, ditching prescriptions, and swiping toilet paper from public restrooms until she can find a job. And we have been steadily collecting listeners' insights on what their workplaces are like right now. The other day, we talked with this guy, Iram Gonzalez, in Tucson, Arizona.
It has changed the mood. I mean, there are times when just nobody wants to be here. I mean, you will walk in here. Like on a Friday, a lot of people work from home. It's kind of gloomy. It just doesn't feel right all the time. I do sense competition at times. I feel that I am working harder. I really don't want to lose this job. I need to be serious about my job. And, you know, I mean, the older I get, the more I feel I have to work harder. I just don't want to be working all my life.
Iram Gonzalez works for a software company, and he listens to the show out in Tucson. He found In the Loop on Facebook, signed up for our network, which is where we put these questions out that we have about the economy or whatever. You can find us on Facebook or go to minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Whatever hope the million-plus people in Washington had on Tuesday, Wall Street didn't feel it. The markets took a dive that day, and they haven't really recovered. Still, lots of jitters about the bailout. We seem to have screwed up the first part, and investors aren't sure Obama's team knows how to get it right. Back when the bailout was still being conceived, we hooked up with an amiable economist with a great Italian name who was deeply skeptical. Seems like now's a good time for another check-in with Luigi Zingales. He's a professor of finance at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Luigi, good to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So you did not like the looks of this bailout from the start, am I right?
That's absolutely correct.
So what just happened here? Did we really blow through $350 billion?
I don't think we blew through the entire amount yet, but we blew through a substantial part of it. This is one case in which you really hope to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 months later, I say I could not have been more right. There's been a pure transfer of money from taxpayers to financial investors with no benefit to the rest of us.
And what would be the benefit to the rest of us that we should have seen, that we should be seeing right now?
What we should be seeing is the economy we're starting, the banks lending, making risky loans, and trying to help out firms that are in trouble. And we have not seen that at all.
Things are bad, but there was a lot of worry that the economy was somehow just going to implode. That hasn't happened, and isn't that a kind of success?
You can always think that things could have gotten worse. But if you look at the list of things that Bernanke threatened and Paulson threatened when they wanted their plan approved, most of them realized they were predicting some banks to fail. They basically fail. The stock market dropped by more than 15%. They predicted GM and Chrysler to fail, and they did fail. I'm not blaming them. I think maybe it was not avoidable at that point. The point is that this was used as sort of a threat to extract something that I think was wrong to begin with.
Did the new Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, give you a very good feeling this week?
I think that he gave me no feeling.
No feeling.
That's the way he should have behaved. And it's if you have a big plan, you don't want to reveal pieces to the market in the middle of the trading day and without having time to explain all the details. That would be foolish. So the fact that he did not reveal anything, I think, was a good thing.
Well, can you read anything on his face? Or do you believe that he and the Obama team actually have a plan that is different and better than the previous plan?
I cannot imagine that the Obama team does not have a plan. And it says, if the Obama team does not come out with a coherent plan in the next week, then I really panic.
All right. The Zingales deadline has been established now on the show here. Tell me about this idea that that you and others have floated about splitting banks into their good parts and their bad parts.
Yes. Let's simplify to the extreme. We have two parts in a bank. We have a lending part, and then we have a part that holds what are called toxic assets.
All this junk, yeah, that got us into so much trouble.
The issue is that the bad part is contaminating the ability of the good part to work. If we were to split the assets, but also to split the liability of a bank into two separate entities, then two things happen. Number one, the bad bank could be managed like as a closed-end fund, because basically what they do, they don't do any real activity except hold this asset to maturity or to sell them out at the best possible price. The good part is that now there is no uncertainty about the value of the assets of the good bank, so the good bank could go back to the capital market and say, you know, now you can finance me without risking huge losses the next day.
So the good part of Bank of America, let's just say, for example, gets to sort of start fresh and not have to worry about all this bad stuff dragging them down. The bad part, well,
absolutely,
somebody's got to deal with it, but it's not connected anymore.
Absolutely.
Last question for you. Someday, are we all going to look back on this time and laugh?
I wish you're right. I don't think so. The damage that has been done here will be with us for a long, long term. I'm not talking only about the debt burden that our children will pay, but also the undermining of the true spirit of American capitalism. We are taking away the sense of responsibility. We are basically creating the precedent to say, you gamble with other people's money, and if you don't succeed, we bail you out.
Well, I gave you an opening there to brighten our day, but I guess I respect your sticking to your economist roots there and remaining gloom and doom. Luigi, thanks very much for spending some time within the loop.
My pleasure.
That's Luigi Zingales. He's a professor of finance at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. I am Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop. This week, we had both the inauguration and the Oscar nominations, and we'll talk more about the Oscars later in the show. But with the stars so beautifully aligned, we put out a challenge to the listeners in our network. Write us a movie trailer previewing the next 4 years. Well, we got a lot of these. I was very impressed. We picked a handful, edited them down, and so, coming to a global theater near you, here's one from Jessica Sundheim up north in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. She set out to capture the enthusiasm, the hope so many people were feeling this week.
In a world so cold, children blow bubbles to watch them shatter. One family joins the many who had lost the dream. Working four jobs to make up for one. One paycheck ahead of disaster. But all is not lost. Out of a warmer region rises a special man. One man who can mobilize a movement just by opening his mouth. Who will utilize the special power and who will throw it all away? New alliances will be born. Old habits will die. Only time will tell if Americans will live the dream again.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. Here's another one, a little more cryptic interpretation of our assignment. This is from Paul Pickelel, who lives in Elk River, Minnesota, and cast things as a, I don't know, kind of a tragic love story, I guess.
They were young and in love, Barack and the world. Poor and getting poorer, they lived for today. Hoping against hope, not afraid to bet their last cent that love would pay the rent. But how will they cope with those bent on destroying their happiness? Barack and the world. Love conquers all.
Thank you, Paul. Tim Nelson of Golden Valley sent in a trailer as well with a good dose of healthy skepticism in it, which we like here. Tim, I know you had a lot to say. We had to cut you down a little bit, but here's the gist of it.
In a world of techno geeks, this new administration motors into the new century by funding last century's technology. Road crews build shovel-ready projects that are sure to save the planet, assuming you like the planet just as it is. New rail projects are hailed as the buzzword of our times. Progress, it seems, is investing in the old ways, if the old ways produce jobs.
All right. Thank you, Tim. And we've got one more here. This is from Stacia Marlett of Hopkins. Seemed like she was pitching some combination of an action flick and a buddy movie, maybe. Not entirely sure. See what you think.
In 2009, one man finds common ground with an enemy based on rhyming names. Coming soon, Obama finds Osama.
Now, we already took down the guy with my middle name as his first name. So this is the next logical step. And I think you'll agree, long overdue.
Just one letter keeps them apart. Obama finds Osama. I mean, Osama finds Obama. Coming this summer to a theater near you.
Thank you, Stacia, and thanks to everybody who sent in scripts to us. I think we might do this again before long. A couple voiceovers there, courtesy of Mark Benninghoffen and Joe Weissman of Shout Radio Productions here in the Twin Cities. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Think about the mythology, the sense of place that we associate with our recent presidents. Bush, ranch in Texas. Clinton, backwoods Arkansas. Bush Sr., the coast of Maine. Reagan, the Wild West. Carter, peanut farm, of course. Obama's turf is Chicago. He's the first urban president we've had in a long while. And among all the pressing things he's dealing with right now, he's also setting up a new office with a secretary to head it, the Office of Urban Affairs. To talk about the implications of having a city guy in the White House, we've got Professor Ed Goetz. He's the director of the Urban and Regional Planning Program at the University of Minnesota. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What are we talking about here when we're talking about urban policy? I presume sort of measures to address poverty, housing.
Transportation, infrastructure, economic development, job creation, maybe education policy as well, the reform of urban schools. But that's what it's been in the past. I would think that going forward, the Obama administration and Congress more generally would be more expansive in their conception of what is urban policy. Think about transportation in all of its aspects as urban policy. To think about what the EPA does in all of its aspects as urban policy, creating sustainable living environments or not. And that's what's really going to make a difference going forward.
Well, the Obama team says right now, federal programs, not only do they not help cities, they actively undermine the country's cities. What are they talking about there?
There's a couple of ways to think about this. Some public policies are intentionally designed to have an effect on cities. Other policies will have unintended effects on cities. The two best examples exist in our transportation policy and our housing policy. Beginning with transportation policy, the 1956 Highway Transportation Act, which created the interstate highway system. One of the things that that act accomplished was it helped facilitate suburbanization. It helped to drain economic resources out of central cities. Combine that with the Federal Housing Administration. This was a program that was created to generate home ownership. What it did was to primarily ensure new mortgages in suburban areas. And it also facilitated, again, the movement of white families out of the central cities and into the suburbs. And so here are two programs that weren't created as urban programs, but that have had tremendous effects on the built environment, the built form of cities and urban areas in the United States.
Is it possible that the government, by creating an Office of Urban Policy and really focusing on this, can mess cities up even more by getting more involved?
Paying attention to something is usually better than ignoring it. And the federal government does many things that affect cities. And right now, we don't pay attention to that, not in any systematic way. Let me give you one really important example coming down the pike fairly soon. This economic stimulus package that the new administration wants to create, that's going to be a combination of tax cuts, but most of it's going to be new spending on public works. Most of that is going to occur in urban areas. This economic stimulus plan is probably going to be the biggest urban policy since the 1960s. And yet nobody's talking about it in that way.
What do you think the effect on the country will be of his, just going to coin a phrase here, his urban personality, the fact that he does identify as somebody from the south side of Chicago and not, say, a guy with a ranch in Texas or a guy from, the mountains of Arkansas?
many of our urban areas, many of our central cities, although they've experienced declines in population from the 60s through 2000, since 2000, or especially since 1990s, many central cities have experienced increases in population, especially downtowns. So I think that Obama's urban personality or urban background, as you described it, is probably consistent with that. And I think we'll both reflect the kind of re-urbanization of America that we're seeing and maybe even drive some more of it.
So many things that feel like good urban policy are also things that, let's face it, Democrats support. Can Republicans who still hold some keys in Congress get behind urban policy?
That's a very good question, and I don't really have the answer to that. I'd probably be much more powerful if I had the answer to that.
But we'll speculate.
If we adopt this more expansive view of urban policy, then we're not just talking about central cities. We're talking about central cities and suburban areas, how they interact, and the sustainability of our suburban development. Then I think you're going to have the interest of people who haven't shown interest in urban policy in the past.
Ed, it's been good to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ed Goetz is the director of the program in urban and regional planning at the University of Minnesota. Now, at least once in this show, let's have a completely Obama-free conversation. As I mentioned earlier, the Oscar nominations are out. And I'm not going to give you a big list because that is what the internet is for. But we were talking about it around the office the other day, and I was chatting with Anna Wagle. Anna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Yes.
You've heard Anna's name in our credits from time to time. She helps us produce segments here on the show. And you are a huge moviegoer, true?
So many hours of my life in movies.
Well spent?
Sometimes. Sometimes not.
What do you think of the nominations this year? Are you happy?
For the most part, although I have some qualms with the Best Picture nominees. I really liked Milk and Slumdog Millionaire. Wasn't a big fan of Benjamin Button. It's just long.
It takes a long time for a guy to go from old to young, and you got to see every piece of it.
Yeah,
right?
I know, but it also takes a long time to have a narrator who doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie narrate the entire thing.
So that's three of the five nominees. What are the other two?
Yeah, the other two are Frost Nixon and The Reader. And I.
How'd you like those?
I sadly have not seen them. Thank you.
I have not seen most of these movies, and part of that's because I have a young kid and it's just hard now, but part of it's because how excited can I get about going out and seeing all of these depressing films?
Oh my, they are harder to watch than any other year that I have seen movies.
What's been the effect on your mental state of these hours in a darkened theater with people getting beat up and having their lives destroyed?
I watch these movies holding my head because I am so depressed. The past four winners for Best Picture have been No Country for Old Men, The Departed, Crash, and Million Dollar Baby. Mm-hmm. And all of those are really difficult movies to see, so maybe it's a trend.
Well, depressing equals serious equals art equals worthy of an Oscar, I guess. We're in this really depressing world right now in lots of ways, and it's almost like all these movies are made to fit the times. But these things have been in the pipeline for years, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to think that these movies were written and planned for these current times, but most of the screenplays for this year's nominees were written 2006 or sometimes way earlier.
So take me through some of your most depressing moments from some of these films.
We've got gruesome images from The Wrestler. I thought that was going to be a feel-good movie where a dad is reunited with his long-lost daughter.
Well, you've got a clip to cheer us up from The Wrestler here, right?
Yep.
Okay, let's listen.
I used to try to forget about you. But I can't. You're my little girl. And now I'm an old broken down piece of meat and I'm alone. And I deserve to be all alone.
And that was Mickey Rourke playing The Wrestler. And when he says that he's a beaten down old man, like, they show him being beaten down.
Tell me quickly about Slumdog Millionaire, which everybody's hearing all about. It sounds like an uplifting story, right?
Just because it ends in a Bollywood dance-off does not mean that it's uplifting.
Really? So what's such a downer about it? I mean, isn't it like some kind of Indian Horatio Alger rags-to-riches kind of story, right?
Well, I don't know that guy, but all I know is that scene after scene after scene, worse things happen to this poor little kid. Yes, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but if someone didn't tell me that there was a light, I don't even know if I could have made it through that movie.
Why do we watch these depressing movies? Why do people make them for us?
I don't know, maybe the industry thinks that happy endings are trite and that's why they're making these movies. Maybe people see themselves in these movies or they're just able to say, thank God that's not me. But there must be something about sad movies that just make us feel better about ourselves.
So in the middle of this rotten economy, are they going to scale back and have a more modest Academy Awards ceremony?
Yeah, you would think, but I read earlier this month that it's going to be bigger than ever. They're going to have new sets designed with a big staircase leading up to the podium and a new statuette design and a lavish dinner of marinated sea bass.
Isn't sea bass an endangered fish?
Yes, probably.
What's the rationale behind going all out with the Oscars?
Well, apparently their argument is the economy is the excuse for extravagance and scaling back would only hurt the little people anyway. Think of all the makeup artists and florists and, I don't know, gift preparers that there are that if they just did a press conference, all those people would probably be losing their biggest client of the year.
Fair enough. The Oscars as a job creation engine. Anna, thanks for watching all those movies. Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Anna Weigle works with Public Insight Journalism here in our newsroom, and she helps us out quite a bit with In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Presidential comparisons. I don't know if I like them, but I guess they're inevitable. With President Obama, you couldn't get away from it this week. Everyone wants to draw the parallels with probably the greatest president of all time, Honest Abe. All through the election, people were talking about it, and the need to fill column inches for special inauguration sections finally let loose a torrent of articles. It's an interesting notion, Obama and Lincoln. And so, in the final act here, our star-crossed heroes meet at last to compare notes.
Well, hello, Mr. Lincoln.
Huh?
How do you do? Everybody's telling me I'm a lot like you. The more I think about it, I suppose it's true.
Even way up here, yes, I've been hearing that too.
See, we're both from Illinois, both tall and thin. We both served just one term before our ship came in. We're both self-made men, did a lot on our own.
We're like the greatest debaters the world has ever known.
Yeah.
Without question.
Well, now actually, I have to admit, my debate performances were kind of underwhelming.
That's true. You actually came off kind of stiff and dull, but in the end, people presumed you knew what you were talking about, and you didn't wander around aimlessly like that John McCain. I'll give you points for that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, I'm sure we've got lots more in common.
Oh, I'm sure we do.
We both took the helm at a time of great crisis.
Our predecessors left us lots of nasty surprises.
Bring the country together. Overcome opposition.
While we battled depression and a thyroid condition. Yes, we did. Both of us.
Now, actually, I'm in pretty good shape.
Oh.
I'm thinking of upgrading the basketball court at the White House, you know?
Well, that sounds nice. I used to cry myself to sleep and struggle with chronic constipation.
Mr. Lincoln, that sounds dreadful.
Well, you know, I'm Lincoln.
Two brash young lawyers, raised on modest means.
Calm and collected is in our genes.
We overcame challenge in our personal lives.
Like keeping on task despite our crazy wives, am I right?
What? Wait, no, that's not true at all.
The South seceded in a matter of days.
Well, I've got people worried about their 401ks. We do what it takes to give our land a fresh start.
You know, killing your fellow Americans, that'll be the hardest part.
Whoa!
I'm just warning you.
Now, wait a minute. I'm not sure I want to be you after all.
Really? My life was awesome.
If that's what it takes to be one of the greatest presidents ever, then I'm out.
Look, Barack, you don't have to be the greatest. Just be yourself.
Oh, Lincoln, you've got a real way with words.
Best there ever was, kid. Now get on out there and be pretty good.
You got it, sir.
In the Loop is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We're edited by Kate Smith. Thanks to Joe Weissman for playing Lincoln to my Obama. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I am going home for an Obama-free weekend.